Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Dr. Michelle Lambert, pediatric hematologist at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and I'm joined today by Dr. Haniel Semkeri, adult hematologist at Massachusetts General Hospital. These are our disclosures. Today we're going to discuss improving outcomes for pediatric and adult patients with immune thrombocytopenia. Today our learning objectives are shown below, and this is what we'll focus on. I'm going to start and talk about pediatric ITP diagnosis and management, and then Hanny's going to talk about adult diagnosis and management. So my objectives are to highlight the recommendations from our 2019 guidelines on pediatric ITP management and describe rationale for areas of significant change, discuss limitations in areas that need future research, and emphasize the need for shared decision making. We all know that pediatric ITP peaks at around 1 to 5 years, and that ITP in general has a bimodal distribution with a peak in early childhood and then a peak in later adulthood. There's actually a third peak in adolescents and young adults as well, and that peak tends to be in female patients, whereas the other two peaks tend to be in male patients. So let's start with a case. Patient LD is a 2-year-old male who's previously well on no medications, and he presents for his first hematology visit with bruising and petechiae, no wet purpura. He's had no trauma, no hematuria. He has no new medications. He's otherwise stable, eating and drinking well, but he did present with a diffuse petechial rash, and his platelet count was noted to be 5,000. He has thrombocytopenia with normal platelet appearance with variable size. Some of them are large. And he has normal white cells, normal differentiation and morphology, normal red cell morphology, and he has no evidence of hemolysis. And this is what a pediatric patient with ITP should look like, although they may have a mild anemia if they have active bleeding. So what are the 2019 ASH recommendations regarding hospitalization or management of our patients? The question of hospitalization was broken into two parts: patients with a really low platelet count, less than 20, and patients with platelet counts greater than 20, and no randomized clinical trials were identified that specifically addressed this question, but benefits were determined to be trivial as long as reliable follow-up was ensured, and there was significant cost savings. And so, in general, the guidelines recommend against admission to the hospital in favor of outpatient management, regardless of platelet count. Ensuring that a pediatric hematologist sees the patient within 24 to 72 hours of diagnosis. Considerations for hospitalization might be that if you're uncertain about the diagnosis, or if you're not sure about follow-up, or if the patient really lives a long distance from the hospital and you're going to require them to go home and then come back again just 24 or 48 hours later and travel long distances. And then when thinking about whether or not to treat patients who have no or minor bleeding, just skin bleeding basically, the panel recommends observation over corticosteroids, observation over IVIG, and observation over anti-D globulin. Basically, observation over any first-line therapies for pediatric patients with no or minor bleeding. And this recommendation was made with strong to moderate certainty. And we know there are differences in the epidemiology of pediatric and adult ITP. Most of our pediatric patients spontaneously resolve and have very acute onset of their bleeding symptoms. They have very few comorbidities at diagnosis, and they have very few medications that affect their bleeding risk at the time of diagnosis. And these differences really drive the differences in recommendations for management between pediatric and adult ITP, because most of these patients are very healthy. It's a sudden onset of disease. They're very likely to resolve relatively quickly, and they're really not on other medications medications that are going to change the risk calculation for whether or not your patient's going to bleed. And that's part of why we have these recommendations that recommend observation over any first-line therapy in pediatric ITP. Spontaneous resolution generally happens between 6 to 12 months, and it's very common in most of our patients. And we can look and see in this figure that most patients have platelet counts that are significantly better by 6 months, and almost everybody has resolved by 12 months post their initial diagnosis of ITP. And so when we're looking at whether or not to treat our patients, we have very nice data that recently came out in the form of the TIKI trial that actually randomized pediatric patients to get IVIG versus observation. And this is a randomized controlled trial that looked at over 200 patients. And in this randomized controlled trial, there was a difference in the time to platelet count recovery early on. And so those patients that got IVIG did have higher platelet counts at 3 months. But by 6 months, that difference in platelet count recovery was really negligible. And by a year, there was no difference in platelet counts between the two groups. And then again, less comorbidities, and there's fewer medications that are associated with increased bleeding. Although it is interesting to note that bleeding at diagnosis is a little bit more common in pediatric patients, and this may be in part due to this very acute and sudden onset of thrombocytopenia. When we look at severe bleeding in pediatric patients, there was a recent review that looked at 29 studies looking at over 2,000 patients reporting bleeding as a categorical variable. 15% of patients met criteria for severe bleeding, and that was 9.6% of adults, but 20% of children. Although the children were much less likely to have intracranial hemorrhage, there was significant bleeding in the pediatric population. And when we look at other studies that specifically looked at things like intracranial hemorrhage in ITP patients, we can see that the incidence of intracranial hemorrhage is higher in adult patients than it is in pediatric patients, but that there is a somewhat increased incidence of bleeding. So why do adults get intracranial hemorrhage? Well, we think the highest risk for intracranial hemorrhage is in the older adults over 60 years of age. Many of those patients have comorbidities associated with increased risk for intracranial hemorrhage. 29% of those patients are taking medications that increase risk of bleeding compared to overall 10% of adults with ITP, newly diagnosed ITP. And in children, 7% of children had comorbid conditions. 14% of those children were taking medications compared to 1% of all children with newly diagnosed ITP. And so certainly taking medications that increase your risk of bleeding are associated with an increased risk of intracranial hemorrhage. So let's look at another case. This is a 14-year-old male with new onset epistaxis. His platelet count is 2,000. He's previously had multiple normal platelet counts. He is a star hockey player on his high school team. He has ongoing intermittent epistaxis, and he does have oozing wet purpura. So you've decided your patient will benefit from treatment. So the question is, what treatment are you going to use? Are you going to do corticosteroids, IVIG, anti-D immunoglobulin? Or are you going to go straight to a second-line therapy? The major challenges with trying to answer the question of what to do in developing guidelines was that there were no uniformly accepted platelet thresholds at which really we should be treating all patients. There's not a strong correlation between severe bleeding and platelet count, although platelet count tends to be used as a surrogate for clinical outcomes of interest. And there's heterogeneity above which threshold we should be treating, or below which threshold we should be treating patients. There's lack of evidence for whether hospitalization provides benefit in these patients. There's definitely lack of evidence on observation in patients who have mild to moderate bleeding, especially pediatric patients. And there's definitely extreme variability in corticosteroid dosing when you're looking at all the steroid clinical trials. There's dosing that varies from less than 1 mg/kg per day to, you know, high dose dexamethasone dosing. And there's a lack of reporting outcomes of interest beyond just bleeding or what the platelet count turns out to be after you treat a patient. So when the ASH panel considered treatment, they looked at three separate comparisons. They looked at corticosteroids versus anti-D, corticosteroids versus IVIG, and anti-D versus IVIG. That's really the kind of data they were able to pull from the literature. They prioritized outcomes, including major bleeding, mortality, durable response, remission, and health-related quality of life. And these outcomes were specific to individual therapies, and outcomes that were specific to individual therapies were also prioritized. For example, hemolysis with anti-D. And so the recommendations as a result of this analysis, they suggested corticosteroids rather than anti-D, corticosteroids rather than IVIG, and either anti-D or IVIG. And this was a strong recommendation with moderate certainty. Corticosteroid recommendation was a conditional recommendation with very low certainty. And the major factors that influenced the panel recommendations were really lack of data directly comparing the prioritized outcomes, and other factors, including cost and patient-specific factors, were also considered. And weighing all of that, really, it's in general, corticosteroids won out. So after discussing the guidelines, you decide to do corticosteroids. And so then what are you going to do as far as steroid dosing and duration of therapy for this 14-year-old student athlete? And in general, the panel, looking at all of the data that was available, suggested that in newly diagnosed ITP with non-life-threatening bleeding or diminished health-related quality of life, recommended against corticosteroid therapy that lasted longer than 7 days in favor of courses that were 7 days or shorter, suggesting prednisone over dexamethasone. So you treat your patient with corticosteroids, and you notice that there's no epistaxis since he started his steroids, but his platelet count continues to be less than 10. He's only had mild bruising, but he's also complaining of fatigue, and he's really getting depressed because he's had his activities significantly limited. He's not allowed to play hockey. His platelet count is so low. And so what about children with non-life-threatening bleeding or diminished health-related quality of life who don't respond to first-line treatment? His platelet count's still low, even though he's had significant improvement in his platelet count. The panel looked at different second-line therapies. It suggested the use of TPOs rather than rituximab, TPOs rather than splenectomy, and rituximab rather than splenectomy in most pediatric patients. And all of these recommendations were conditional based on very low certainty in the level of effects, in the evidence of effects and in the level of evidence that was available. In general, we really have very limited data, and especially limited data that compares these different therapies against each other. We do have some ability to compare responses over time. And when we're looking at durable remissions in rituximab versus the TPO receptor agonists, we can see that TPO receptor agonists in the open label extension randomized clinical trial did show some durable responses and a significant impact on bleeding. And so rituximab did have attributable infections in about 1.4% of patients, persistent hypogammaglobulinemia, impaired vaccine responses and infusion reactions, as well as some serum sickness. It's very expensive, although the benefit is, rituximab can be expensive, although one of the benefits is that there's no daily medication requirement. It's an IV medication, so if you're worried about adherence, you know your patient's getting it because it's your patient comes in and gets it. And it's relatively short-term treatment. The TPO receptor agonists also have some infections associated with them, although these are generally minor. There's hepatotoxicity and iron deficiency associated with eltrombopag. There's not significant thrombosis seen in the pediatric trials. Although these are long-term treatments, they require continuous medication and they can be quite expensive over the long term. Although you can choose between oral or subcutaneous, choosing the subcutaneous option and bringing your patient into clinic gives you control over whether or not your patient is taking the medication. Considerations for choosing rituximab, the incidence of the severe side effects, anaphylaxis, PML is very rare in ITP, although there is a demonstrated risk of infection. Serum sickness might be a little bit higher in children, and the evidence of sustained response really is that, it's less than 30% long-term responses in pediatric patients. It can be quite expensive. To give a course of rituximab for all four doses. And it's recommended that we monitor for B-cell recovery and performing vaccinations again after rituximab in patients who lose their vaccination responses. So the risks of TPOs are thought to be low, with potential benefits being high, and you avoid immunosuppression. And this is part of why the panel recommended TPO-RAs over rituximab. However, family preference is really important in this decision-making, and if a family really wants to avoid ongoing treatment, or if you're thinking that ITP might be secondary to an underlying immunodeficiency that is already an antibody deficiency, rituximab might be a really good choice. When we're looking at splenectomy, thinking about splenectomy versus a TPO, again, splenectomy provides the possibility of long-term remission and a durable response. And that incidence of durable responses is higher than for the TPO-RAs. And so that generally is the main reason that to choose splenectomy over TPO-RAs. But again, we wouldn't want to choose splenectomy in patients who have newly diagnosed ITP because the rate of spontaneous remission is so high. There is an attributable infection risk in the form of sepsis, and there are operative complications associated with pediatric splenectomy. And so it's important to keep that in mind when discussing the risk-benefit of splenectomy versus TPO-RA or other treatments in pediatric patients. So there is a value to avoid splenectomy early in pediatric patients who have ITP, but in patients who have chronic ITP, especially the patients who have really long-standing ITP, there's definitely a potential benefit to splenectomy, or in patients who are having life-threatening bleeding. And so if we go back to our patient AB and we use the shared decision-making approach and think about our reasons for treatment, which are really fatigue and health-related quality of life. This patient now has persistent ITP. We think it's primary. And we ask the patient about his preferences. He really wants a reliable increase in his platelet count. He wants medicine he can take at home. He doesn't want long-term complications because he's hoping his ITP is going to get better. He and his parents are both hoping it's going to get better, but he really wants to be able to get back to playing hockey. So he wants something that's going to raise his platelet count and keep it up and keep it steadily up. So you start him on a TPO-RA. And 4 years later, he's still on the TPORA, and he's getting ready to go to college. And now he says, you know what, doc, I want a splenectomy because I'm tired of taking this medication every day. I'm going to college. I'll be real. I'm not sure I'm going to remember to take it when I get to school. You know, it's easy when mom reminds me to take it. It's not going to be so easy when I'm living in the dorm. So you you do your evaluation for immunodeficiency. He receives his recommended vaccines. That includes Pneumovax and making sure he's fully immunized against meningococcus. And he proceeds to splenectomy. And this is a really good example of shared decision making. But it's very important that he receives counseling about antibiotic prophylaxis post-splenectomy, and then he remembers that he's really trading one medicine for another medicine. He's trading pneumococcal prophylaxis, his penicillin prophylaxis, post-splenectomy for his TPORA. The difference is that if he forgets his penicillin once in a while, his platelet count's not going to drop. As long as he has the penicillin at home and he knows that he needs to go to the emergency room with fever, it's not as big a deal if he forgets a dose or two of the penicillin. But it's very important that he's very well counseled on the importance of his post-splenectomy care. And with that, I think that was what I wanted to discuss. And I will turn it over to Dr. Asim Kari to talk about the adult ITP management.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Michelle. I appreciate that. I'm going to cover ITP in adults. We're going to talk a bit about diagnostic considerations initially, and then we're going to talk about, guidelines for first and second line treatment and considerations in first and second line treatment, as well as some investigational therapies at the end. So I also have a case that we will use to frame the discussion. A 66-year-old woman with a past medical history of hypertension and Sjogren's syndrome presents to the ED with diffuse petechiae of the upper and lower extremities. She awoke this morning to the taste of iron in her mouth and saw large blood blisters on her oral mucosae. On initial labs, her platelet count is 4,000. The remainder for CBC is unremarkable. She mentions she recovered from a case of bronchitis about 3 weeks ago. So, this is sort of a classic presentation of newly diagnosed ITP. And, you know, again, as in children, we think of ITP in adults as primary or versus secondary ITP. And in adults, 80% falls into this quote unquote primary bucket. And 20% falls into the secondary bucket, of which the ITP is diagnosed in association with a certain infection, immunodeficiency, autoimmune disease, lymphoproliferative disorder, or receipt of a certain medication. And, you know, if we looked at a pie chart of the breakdown of all the different kinds of secondary ITP, each of these is between 1 and 5% of that 20%. So a very heterogeneous bucket. We also classify ITP according to its chronicity, right? So we don't say acute ITP, we say newly diagnosed ITP, because acute could be an exacerbation in a patient with chronic ITP, an acute on chronic exacerbation. So we talk about newly diagnosed ITP, less than 3 months of duration, persistent ITP, and then chronic ITP. And, you know, this is relevant because many of the medications we talk about have been approved for certain ITP of a certain chronicity, but not ITP of other chronicities. So when we talk about ITP, when we think about ITP, the first thing we think about is, of course, bleeding. And as Dr. Lambert pointed out, there is not a specific threshold that, for adults as well as in children, a platelet count that we say the person is absolutely safe above this threshold or clearly not safe below that threshold. They're really variable. And, you know, we tend to stick to a threshold of, say, above 20,000 puts most adults with ITP out of the danger zone in terms of spontaneous bleeding risk. We often require a higher number in those patients who are receiving antithrombotic therapies, antiplatelet and anticoagulation therapies, as well as those who need surgical procedures. Older adults with ITP in particular tend to not respond or tend to not have as close of a relationship between their platelet count and their bleeding manifestations as do younger adults with ITP. And we recognize that bleeding risk does increase with age. But in general, if somebody's platelet count is in the single digits, that's a cause for concern. So in our case, a diagnosis of ITP is made. If questioned beyond bleeding symptoms, what symptom is the patient most likely to endorse? A, depression, B, anxiety, C, headache, D, fatigue, E, insomnia. So as we think about ITP, we have to remember that this is a bleeding disorder, but it is also a systemic autoimmune problem, which can cause other manifestations. And right, the consequence of having a very low platelet count can lead to certain psychosocial manifestations and psychiatric manifestations of the disease. So if you said fatigue, you were right. Fatigue is very common in adults with ITP, being reported by a majority of patients at the time of diagnosis. And as you can see, over 70%, this figure was taken from a very large health-related quality of life study in ITP called the IWISH study. Over 70% of patients with fatigue were reported the symptom as severe. But if we look at this, you know, we see petechiae and bleeding are very, very high in terms of the percentage of patients reporting it. That's not surprising, but we see a number of other problems on here, right? We see depression on here. We see, various bleeding manifestations beyond the typical petechiae and bruising that we see. We see anxiety as a major manifestation and reported as severe in almost 80% of patients. So it's something that we have to recognize. And if we look at the same graph, except not at diagnosis, but later in the disease course, there's fatigue again, poking out like a sore thumb, with over 50% of patients continuing to describe fatigue and over 60% saying it's severe. And we see anxiety, still a major issue. More patients reporting severe fatigue and anxiety than reporting severe bleeding. So I think it's really important that we recognize that there are multiple pillars of symptoms in ITP that we have to think about. Bleeding is, of course, the first, and physicians are very good about being concerned about their patients bleeding and bleeding risk, but we have to recognize the other symptoms of ITP, like fatigue, as well as the psychological consequences of having this disease and the toxicity of our therapies. And so we have to consider those really almost as equally important in many cases. One of the questions that I get all the time is, okay, so fatigue is common. Does it correlate with the platelet count? Well, from the IWISH study, it appears that it does not, or at least does not for many patients. Certain patients may swear it does, and they can tell they're having an exacerbation because of their fatigue before they even get a platelet count checked. And that's absolutely true within certain patients. But on a population level, it may not correlate. So this is something that we have to recognize and oftentimes have to discuss with our patients. They may not be as forthcoming with fatigue, anxiety, and those issues. So going back to the case, which of the following diagnostic tests is indicated at diagnosis in this patient? 66-year-old patient who presents with newly diagnosed ITP, a bone marrow biopsy, direct glycoprotein-specific platelet autoantibodies, hepatitis C serology, antiphospholipid antibodies, or direct antiglobulin test, right? So this brings us to what other workup do we need to do in the adult with newly diagnosed ITP? So let's talk about it. So ITP is classically thought of as a diagnosis of exclusion, although I like to call it a diagnosis of recognition, right? Sort of know a case when you see it most of the time. It turns out we're not perfect at this, right? As you can imagine, but we're pretty good. If you've seen a dozen, two dozen, three dozen cases of ITP, you start to have this recognition that what you're looking at is probably ITP just based on the platelet count, the MPV, the peripheral blood smear, how patients present, even without doing any workup for other causes of thrombocytopenia. Most patients do present asymptomatically in adults, and we see the diagnosis via routine blood tests, and somebody's having a blood test checked for another reason. These are not your acute patients that have a platelet count of 6. These are patients that have a platelet count of 50 or 40, and there's no other explanation for it, so it gets thrown in the ITP bucket. And there's this recommended diagnostic evaluation. So according to international consensus guidelines, we have a series of very simple things that are recommended for all adults with ITP, which includes your typical history, physical, CBC, peripheral blood film examination, quantitative immunoglobulin level measurement, which is relevant to understand if there's any immunologic correlates, immunodeficiency correlates, as well as understanding what that looks like before giving certain therapies like rituximab. And then we have hepatitis, serologies, and HIV. So the question I presented before, hepatitis C serology would be the correct answer there. Now, there are other tests, right, that may be of use, and that at ITP referral centers we often get, right, things like platelet autoantibody testing, things like a thrombopoietin level, things like antiphospholipid testing. These are things that can be relevant, and certainly if you talk to your patient and, you know, a patient has a history of significant autoimmune disease, you know, you may want to get antiphospholipid testing, for example, the rest of these are really patient and situation dependent. Now, we are not perfect at diagnosing ITP, so the McMaster ITP registry looked at this, and, you know, we're right about 85% of the time, but about 12% of the time, people who were diagnosed with ITP ultimately didn't have it, and 3% of patients that were diagnosed with something else ultimately did have it. This is a major ITP referral center. This was in adults. There was a similar study done in children with similar findings. We do have these ambiguous cases in practice. One just quick point about platelet autoantibody testing, highly variable studies on this, right? So the reason why, one major reason why all of the guidelines don't recommend it as standard, despite the fact that we recognize that patients with ITP often have these platelet autoantibodies, is that it's so difficult to do it right, and there's so many things that can impact the results, and there's a lot of variability in the sensitivity found in a whole host of studies in the literature. The specificity seems to be better. And in a ITP systematic review in adults here, the specificity seemed to be above 90%. So that's one useful aspect of this testing. But with sensitivity mired in the sort of overall 50 to 70% range, it's much more challenging to recommend this and use it as a diagnostic test. Similar findings in a pediatric ITP systematic review. We have to remember in adults our differential diagnosis of ITP. So very common for patients that have this sort of mild thrombocytopenia, that perhaps they have some undiagnosed liver disease, perhaps they have undiagnosed clonal hematopoiesis, things to consider. So in going back to our case, a patient is admitted for treatment of newly diagnosed ITP. When told she is to receive treatment, including corticosteroids, she becomes anxious as she states a prior 3-day methylprednisolone pulse given for a complication of her Sjogren's gave her severe anxiety and insomnia while she was getting the pulse. Which of the following is the next best step in the management of this patient? So we could give her a moderate dose of prednisone over a 6-week taper, which is sort of a typical treatment course in adult ITP. We could say, well, let's give the dex pulse. We could give her IVIG, or we could give her a combination of those things, right? So in this case, it's very reasonable to give either IVIG or a moderate dose prednisone taper. She probably won't have the same symptoms she did with the very high methylprednisolone pulse of 1 gram per day with a smaller dose of prednisone. But if she did, one could then switch, for example, to IVIG. So those are the options. Now she's not actively having severe bleeding, so we really don't need to reach for combination therapy at this point. So, you know, when we talk about treatment of ITP, we talk about treat the disease while trying to minimize the toxicity as best as possible. And one of the things we recognize nowadays is that we use too much steroids in this disease. I mean, Michelle, you pediatric colleagues, you have this way better than we do. In the adult setting, corticosteroids are the most common treatment selected in any course of therapy, first line, second line, third line. There's recent data on this. We've got to do better. So we need to follow your lead in the pediatric world. In addition to managing the platelet count and the bleeding, we have to make sure that we're not causing toxicity. We need to make sure that we're engaging in shared decision making, and I'm about to get to that in the second line therapy, which is the same in adults as in pediatrics in terms of the shared decision making being a very important aspect. Talk to patients about what their values are and find the right therapy that works for them and their comorbidities.
I'll just point out that
please.
7 days of steroids versus taper over 6 weeks, right?
That's right.
Like, we're talking about a monumental difference, even in the lower dose of steroids that you're proposing.
That's exactly right. And I mean, you know, in adults, if we were to stop after 7 days, you know, we probably wouldn't have, you know, much benefit at all. But at the same time, you know, people go way longer than 6 weeks. People are on it for 12 weeks or 16 weeks sometimes before they get on another therapy. And we really, you know, that's something you really want to avoid. It's just so easy to restart the steroids when the platelet count drops. And it's harder to start a second line therapy in terms of the activation energy to do that. It shouldn't be, right? But
we do 7 days and then we're like, oh, you failed. Okay, time to move to the next line of therapy.
And that's something that we should be doing much more in the adult world. So, you know, here are some additional differences, right, between adults and pediatrics, just in terms of what the American Society of Hematology guidelines recommend. So first one, you know, platelet count less than 30,000 who are asymptomatic in terms of the corticosteroids versus observation in newly diagnosed patients, the recommendations for corticosteroids rather than management with observation in those patients the first time around. If patients have a count of greater than 30, then observation is recommended. It's also recommended that patients have a platelet count less than 20 at the time of their first ITP, you know, first presentation with ITP, newly diagnosed ITP, or if they have even just minor bleeding, that they are in fact admitted to the hospital rather than management as an outpatient, which is very different, right, in adults than in the pediatric world. Michelle, I saw you shaking your head. Thoughts on that?
We try so hard not to admit anyone with ITP, unless they're having like lots of bleeding. If you're having a lot of bleeding, you know, significant menorrhagia, your hemoglobin is 7, you know, GI bleeding, something like that, an intracranial hemorrhage, heaven forbid, then we'll admit you. But if you have epistaxis and it stops, then we're going to send you home with prednisone. Bye.
And
see you
know,
tomorrow.
We have these, you know, ITP hostages in the hospital waiting for their platelet count to get above 20 or 30,000 so they can go home. Sometimes it takes several days. It's very rare for somebody to have a significant bleeding event, but, you know, based on, you know, the sort of difference in adult patients versus pediatric patients, these were the recommendations. There can be more going on in an adult patient, more likely to have comorbidities,
sure,
potentially a higher risk for a major bleeding event. So recommendation admission to the hospital. And then, as I've really already harped on, really want to limit the duration of steroids in these patients. And you don't need to use massive doses of prednisone. You know, 1 mg/kg, something close to that is fine. And the the dexamethasone pulse is just 40 times 4 days. Often will need to be repeated once or twice in that initial 6 week period. So in terms of other recommendations, IVIG is recommended when a more rapid increase in platelet count is required. Patients presenting with more substantial bleeding are at a high risk for having severe bleeding based on their comorbidities or other issues that patient has. If corticosteroids are truly contraindicated, you can go directly to IVIG or anti-RhD immune globulin. And then pregnant patients receive either steroids or IVIG in the newly diagnosed setting. So I don't want to spend too much time on steroids, but just to remind everybody that in meta-analyses of large randomized controlled trials in adults, there really is not a significant difference between doing a prednisone taper and doing dexamethasone pulsing in an adult patient with ITP. You may get a slightly quicker response with the dexamethasone pulse, at the cost of perhaps a higher risk of having acute steroid-related side effects, things like insomnia, anxiety, and potentially psychosis. And that is especially true for older adults. So we have to keep that in mind. This is just an example of that graphically, right? Overall response rate at 6 months, no significant difference between prednisone and dexamethasone. IVIG, we want to use this in our patients who have steroid contraindications or who are actively acutely bleeding. Those patients also that are at significantly increased risk of having bleeding relative to the general population. We especially in patients who've had a prior substantial bleed during an ITP exacerbation, we want to think about IVIG. But we have to remember that IVIG is not a Completely benign treatment, right? There are potential side effects, things like headache, aseptic meningitis, venous thromboembolism. So we have to consider that. Anti-RSG immune globulin really is not reached for as much anymore, but in those patients who cannot receive IVIG, patients who are Rh positive, this is a treatment option. It has a response rate similar to IVIG. You just have to look out for the hemolytic anemia that you're going to give the patient, mild hemolytic anemia, very rare cases of DIC. So back to our case, the patient responds well to 6-week prednisone taper as first-line therapy, but at routine follow-up 3 months after initial diagnosis, platelet count is 29,000. The remainder of her CBC remains unremarkable, not currently bleeding, not on antithrombotic therapy, lives a sedentary lifestyle, very anxious about her platelet count, wants it to be normal again. All right, so what would we do now? It's 29,000. She's sedentary, not on any blood thinners. Give her more steroids, give her more IVIG. No need to do those things. We talk about using remiplistim, referral for splenectomy. Patient hasn't had ITP for at least a year, so we would avoid splenectomy generally. Observation and reassurance, right? So there are multiple potential right answers here, and we have to talk about the patient, you know, patient's needs. And she's very anxious, so she may prefer to be on something to know her platelet count is going to be normal. So perhaps a long-term treatment is in the cards here. So again, our goals here are to maintain a safe platelet count, minimal toxicity. We want to make sure our treatment is not worse than the disease. We want to obviously prevent bleeding, but at the same time, we have to consider all of the aspects and issues related with chronic therapies or potentially a surgery. She does well with observation reassurance, at which time her platelet counts are 25 to 40,000. At this time, she calls the office because she noticed some new, if minor, petechiae in her legs. She got over a bad cold 2 weeks ago. She's found to have a platelet count of 15,000. So what do we do now? Do we admit her? You know, we probably don't need to admit her. She doesn't have newly diagnosed disease, and she's only has very minor petechiae. We could think about giving her some IVIG and start remiplistim or rituximab or refer for splenectomy. So let's use this to talk about the treatment approach in second line. And I have the same slide here because we have to remember these same things about avoiding excessive toxicity and, you know, making doing a shared decision-making approach with regards to these different options with the patient. So this figure is from the American Society of Hematology updated guidelines. And I really want to direct your focus to the patient places a high value on row, which is right here, this third row, this row of green first row of green boxes here. And that's true for every single treatment option, right? So we want to talk to our patients about what they value, talk to them about what they would like to avoid. And that can really help guide us because we don't have randomized controlled trials comparing avatrombopag to rituximab or comparing splenectomy to remiplistim. We don't have high quality data comparing these second line therapies. So just to briefly mention each of these second line therapies that we think about in adult patients, splenectomy is, you know, in the past we thought of it as the 2/3 cure because a lot of the old data showed durable response rates when given in a second line setting before other therapies, after steroids and or IVIG, durable response rates of about 60 to 70%. But we're doing less and less splenectomy as we have more and more medical therapies. And so the patients getting splenectomy are a little bit more selected out. And so in the modern era, it's not the 2/3 cure anymore. It's really more of a coin flip. In one recent study in patients, adults with ITP receiving prior therapy with TPO-RA and rituximab and failing those, the response rate to splenectomy was actually less than 50% in that group. And so it's really important to consider these predictors of non-response. Older adults, more than 4 prior lines of therapy. So we have to consider that nowadays. Rituximab, I like to think of rituximab in adults as really being kind of a longer-term band-aid. We're probably not curing too many people with rituximab. The long-term response rates drop pretty low, even if the initial response rates are closer to the 50 to 60% range. So we have to think about that. It's not free lunch. It's not as difficult as some of the more long-term therapies, but we're probably not going to put the patient in a long-term durable remission. How important was that?
I usually
Sorry,
say
go ahead.
you want a break from medication for a couple of months. This is
Exactly. That's right. Yeah, I mean, because it's sort of like a longer-term IVIG in some ways. With thrombopoietin receptor agonists, you know, we have multiple different options. These are the four drugs that are approved in the United States for various things. Only three of them are approved for ITP. So remiplistin, L-trombopag, and avatrombopag are the ones available for ITP. You know, patients often prefer an oral treatment in terms of L-trombopag or avatrombopag, but remiplistin is certainly an effective agent and is good for those patients that are not so good at taking their medication at home, right? Because you know you're going to come into the clinic to get the medicine. Avatrombopag is newer, doesn't quite have the safety record as the other two TPARAs in terms of the duration of experience, but doesn't have the dietary restrictions that L-trombopag does. L-trombopag not going to absorb very well if patients have a meal that has significant calcium, magnesium, or dietary fat. That's most meals, so it can be challenging for some patients to take L-trombopag. And again, 10% hepatotoxicity rate with L-trombopag that we don't see with our other TPARAs. So the patient is treated with multiple second-line therapies over 8 years, the 8 years that follow. Most control her disease for an extended period of time, but ultimately fail. She's not undergone splenectomy and is extremely resistant to the surgical option. She still responds to both steroids and IVIG, though the duration of response is both relatively short-lived. For both is relatively short-lived. Platelet count today is 11,000. She has scattered petechiae in her legs. What do we do now? Do we give her chronic steroids? I hope not. Do we give her more IVIG just every 2 weeks? It's a lot of IVIG. So in patients like this, she doesn't want a splenectomy. We should really think about a clinical trial of an investigational drug because we don't want to observe a patient and reassure her her platelet count is 11,000. So I'm going to finish things off by just talking briefly about some investigational therapies for ITP. So I have this here just to remind us that ITP is a complicated disease. It's more than a disease of just platelet autoantibodies destroying platelets. There's involvement of cytotoxic T cells. There's involvement of complement. There's inadequate production of platelets, not decreased production, but inadequate production of platelets in the bone marrow to meet the really high rates of destruction. So one class that's being evaluated right now in clinical trials is the neonatal Fc receptor antagonists. And neonatal Fc receptor antagonists, they block this neonatal Fc receptor. What is that? That is a receptor that is responsible for the half-life of circulating IgG. So with this receptor intact, circulating IgG has a half-life of about 21 days. When you take it out, block the receptor, that half-life goes down to about 7 days. So your circulating IgG levels drop by about 66%. That includes both normal IgG that you have in there and as well as pathologic, right, platelet autoantibodies. And so we can reduce our platelet autoantibodies by blocking the neonatal Fc receptor. And that is exactly the strategy that is being used with a couple drugs. One of them is called rozanolixizumab. And rozanolixizumab is a humanized monoclonal antibody that's been evaluated in a phase 2 study to treat ITP and really does provoke a response and improve platelet counts in relatively dose-dependent fashion, with a most common side effect being headache. Another drug is called efgartigimod. And efgartigimod is an antibody Fc fragment that is being evaluated in ITP, and a phase 2 study also shown to be effective in raising the platelet counts in patients. And as we raise the threshold for what we consider a response here, we see the platelet count, we see the placebo arm start to fail. As we have greater than 50,000 once, the placebo arm does pretty well, but then when we say twice, greater than 100,000 or greater than 50,000 for at least 10 consecutive days, we have the placebo arm failing, the efgartigimod arms having a 30 to 50% response rate. When we look at complement inhibition in ITP, there are actually a couple drugs being evaluated in this regard. This figure is from a phase one study of 12 patients treated with sutimlimab. Sutimlimab is an anti-C1s monoclonal antibody, blocks the classical complement pathway. While leaving the other two complement pathways intact, important for infection risk as we think about that, this drug is FDA approved already for the treatment of cold agglutinin disease and recently published phase one study demonstrates the efficacy in ITP. About six out of 12 patients, or half of patients, responded nicely. This is every 2 week infusions of sutimlimab. Complement activity, the green line, drops like a rock, platelet count recovers nicely. Then when you wash out, those revert. And then when you restart the drug, you get the benefit back once again. There is a new thrombopoietin receptor agonist that has been developed in China called Hetrombopag, and a very large trial in China was shown to be effective in ITP. Right now, use restricted to China, but who knows what will happen with this drug. And then lastly, BTK inhibitors, which have been available now for lymphoid malignancies for quite some time, there's a recognition that these drugs may have value in ITP, given their very potent effects on the B-cell compartment. And so there is a BTK inhibitor currently under investigation in ITP called rilzabrutinib. Rilzabrutinib is a BTK inhibitor that in a clinical trial, a phase 1-2 clinical trial of patients with very relapsed refractory ITP that had received a median of 5 prior therapies, had disease for longer than 6 years, median, so very heavily pretreated group, had about a 40% response rate in raising the platelet count. And in those patients in whom who responded, they typically had a durable response. So this is a certainly potentially promising drug. Now, when we break it down by the different subgroups, we have essentially 40% response rate, irrespective of they had a prior splenectomy or not, they had 4 or more therapies or not. This is obviously promising for these very relapsed refractory patients. And you might say, well, wait a minute, Hanny. These drugs cause a platelet aggregation defect and reduction in platelet function, right? Ibrutinib certainly increases bleeding risk. We wouldn't want to do this in ITP patients. And I would certainly agree with you that that the BTK inhibitors we use to treat lymphoma do seem to have this impact. But rilzabrutinib, or PRN1008, has more selectivity for specific kinases and does appear to avoid this in a small study done looking at healthy volunteers and ITP patients receiving these drugs and having platelet aggregation measured, while platelet aggregation was impaired in certain patients and certain agonists with ibrutinib. It was not impaired with rilzabrutinib, and this is borne out in the early phase studies that have been done with rilzabrutinib. Does not appear as though this drug is causing patients to bleed. So with that, we've gone through kind of a whirlwind through the treatment of both pediatric and adult ITP in the modern day. And thank you very much.